X issue number 22100, rule 2.
Reel 1, side 2, Lieutenant Gordon Cantley.
And there was a compressor truck and a Cook's 1500 weight. Whilst we were in camp, and I joined the squadron at a place called Marston Bigot, which is outside Froome. At that particular time, our CRE was a chap called Dove, who was rudely nicknamed Wings, because he was always up in the air. The squadron leader was Major Thomas. At that time, I can't remember who the 2IC was. And the two other troop leaders at the time were older than myself, a chap called Purdy and a chap called Williamson. Very quickly, they were promoted to captain, and the thing began to grow into more like a fighting organisation, since the Guards Division had really only been formed around about September in the year before, 1942, and it was picking itself up as it went along.
Within the divisional structure was, within the brigade structure, was a field troop allocated specifically to an armoured regiment, or did you operate as a squadron in the field?
Whilst we were training, it was pretty much higgledy-piggledy. Our main objective was, in fact, to clear minefields and to build bridges, as the case may be. That was really the sort of basic training. One would advance and then one would be called forward to build a bridge. Now, normally a bridge is built by more than just a troop, although a troop can, in fact, build one of the smaller bridges on its own and take a little bit longer to do it. But in the main, it was squadron effort building reasonable sized bridges. I can't say that I remember being specifically allocated to a specific unit in a specific regiment during training. The training was not particularly applicable to the fighting that we had to do in Normandy. But nevertheless, probably the prime object of it was to get us as an integral whole rather than disparate parts. At that particular time in Froome, we carried out a bridging exercise, and I sufficiently impressed the OC to be given a troop. So I was given one of these troops, which became spare, as these older chaps were promoted. So I got a troop fairly early on in life. The main thing after that is we did an exercise which was called Exercise Spartan, which was an introduction to reality. In other words, we were supposed to be travelling for 14 days or 14 days and nights, experiencing the worst of the British weather in March, but also being introduced to the latest rationing system, the 14-man compo pack, which was quite excellent. It was there that my lack of knowledge of wireless procedure came to the fore, because at that stage I was travelling, my allocated armoured car was a Daimler two-man Dingle, which is quite a splendid little vehicle, but damn cold. And one would get the message over, and reference was made to something called Slidex. I had no idea what Slidex was, so we had a long argument over the air. So I was made to learn all about Slidex when we came back from the exercise. But nevertheless, this revealed the lack of up-to-dateness of the training at the OCTU. However, we did this exercise. My memory of the exercise is it wasn't particularly cold. It wasn't particularly wet, but it was bloody cold. The only thing that comes to my mind in that exercise are two things. One, I was up front for some reason at one particular stage in the game, but not right at the sharp end. and the bridge was reported blown, so the CRE grabbed me, this is our friend Wings, and made me set out a bridge and a field at the side, to which the OC, when he came up, said, this is rubbish, I'm going to put it across the existing bridge. The other thing that happened was that I was getting so damn tired that I fell asleep, and when I woke up, I was with a Canadian division passing through the place where the place begins with the B, with the woman on the white horse, Banbury, which was rather upsetting. However, I managed to get back to the divisional centre line after that. I don't think anybody knew about this. The other thing that happened was that I had my armoured section with me. We normally move with an armoured section, which was either number 4 section or number 5 section. They travelled in the half track. So the three of us vehicles in this in this Canadian division centre line. Anyway, we got back on track. But then somehow, for some reason, out in the wild blue yonder, it might have been whilst trying to get back onto the centre line, we're coming up to this bridge, and I saw an umpire up at the top and 3 or 4 armoured cars, and suddenly realised that this was the enemy at a blown bridge. So I said, quickly turn round. We managed to turn round, but these armoured cars come battling up, and the officer in command says, you're all dead. And I said, no, I've been shooting at you with this brain gun, you see. So I had an argument, and then the umpire agreed, all right, well, we'll take the sappers out, but you can go away. That was my experience of exercise smart and bloody cold.
why were you selected to go to the Guards Armoured? Was it just pure fate, or
no? Maybe they thought I could withstand the Guards officers. I don't know, but I went to the Guards Armoured. One or two others had volunteered airborne. They went airborne too, and one went to 9th Armoured, but the others went to different field units.
And how did you find working with the Guards?
Working with the Guards was difficult, particularly on exercises. They were very good soldiers and highly disciplined, but their idea of keeping you in the picture was pretty miserable. So you would attend an O group during one of these exercises, and you'd be told the task of the such and such and the such and such and such and such, and when you ask them, what is the task of the sappers, they would look look at you, what are sappers? Nevertheless, they developed, and the division was pretty good at the time it was ready to go overseas. We had Wings had disappeared, and we'd had a chap called Jones, Splosh Jones, who'd got an MC on the route to Dunkirk, and he was really very good. He cracked us into shape. We used to go on bridging exercises, and bridge until you drop down absolutely exhausted. Sappers would be launching an anchor, and they'd go over the side with the anchor, so tired. But it was good experience, and it was a good division, a good divisional RE, very good divisional RE. We knew what we were doing.
And you mentioned earlier the fact that you trained a lot on minefield clearance.
Yeah.
What knowledge did you have at this stage on German mines, the way they work, how they operated, how they would lay out a minefield? Did you have that degree of detail?
We had descriptive rather than hands-on. But to jump ahead, we had moved up to Kelty Castle with the division after our exercise Spartan. There was a short period of time in Norfolk, but fundamentally we moved to Kelty Castle in Yorkshire, and up there the division began to become a whole, if you understand what I mean. and we did our own practices. We did our own practices in laying minefields and lifting mines, but in the main they were British mines. The only time we had hands-on experience of German mines was when we were preparing to go overseas down in Brighton, which was in 1944, when we received a selection of German mines, including their pattern of removal and also their pattern of laying the mines. I'll come to that later on if you like, but that really was the sort of situation. We did demolitions, we built bridges using timber and RSJs and things of this sort of stuff, but fundamentally we were doing Bailey bridging, we were doing demolitions, and we were doing mines. We did teach the signals certain minor demolitions so that they could clear away broken telephone poles and this sort of stuff, but in the main the only time I ever came in contact with the guards as a training exercise was as my troop was sent to I can't remember which guards regiment it was, but they wanted to do Bangalore torpedo experience, and we were sent to support them on this particular exercise, which my memory of it was that we put the Bangalore torpedo under the wire and we lit the bloody fuse and we retired and it failed to go off. So I had to dash forward with a lump of gun cotton and put it on the Bangalore and poop it off. Not terribly impressive.
Okay, so the division gradually pulled itself together over the period of 1943.
That's right.
At what stage did you start to get some warning orders for the invasion?
We had, in the intervening period of time, at Kelly Castle, I had been posted to 143 Octu as a training officer. So I was up there for 3 months near my home, which was quite pleasant because it allowed me to get home on the occasional weekend. But up there I was training LFC officers who were much older than I was, and the only sort of field exercises that we had was when we had to cycle down to a battle camp near Peebles, and on that particular exercise they had sergeants who used to fire live ammunition at or around you and generally play at soldiers again. We used to throw grenades and fire live ammunition, etc., etc. I think that I came up against the commanding officer of that unit because we'd thrown a couple of grenades and they hadn't gone off. And this was in down on the moors, and I was sent back to find these bloody things, and I couldn't find them. So I had to tell him I couldn't find them, and he wasn't at all pleased. So I had only one session with them, but I'm not sure that was the cause of it. I think the cause of it was that I really was not LFC. I was field by this time. So I was posted back to 14 Field Squadron, and this would be early 1944. And then early-ish 1944. And then when the invasion took place, or prior to the invasion, we were moved to a secure area outside Brighton, a place called Peacehaven, and the squadron was in a house down there, and it was at that particular stage we started to do fairly serious route marches. I think I mentioned 25 miles daily, but I don't think that was right. I think we probably maybe did 10 or 12 miles. But we did a fair number of route marches to harden us up, and I was delegated to give a mines course to the squadron. So it was at that particular time we got all these bits and pieces. So we did a mines course, which included everybody down to the clerk, so that if they came up against a mine, they knew what to do with it, and the drivers. And this was quite a good course because we used to booby trap the mines with a detonator, so if somebody made a mistake, the bloody thing went off, the detonator, And we used to put people into gas masks with the thing. So they were all doing it blind. And it was quite remarkable how people improved. You know, the first two or three attempts, they would put the bloody thing off, but after a bit, they got wise to it. So it was a well-trained squadron with regard to mines when we went overseas.
Before you were posted, before the move overseas occurred, were you briefed on likely divisional tasks? Did you know what you were going to?
No, not a thing. Not a thing, as I recall it. I'm not sure anybody except Montgomery knew what the hell he was doing at that particular time. And certainly we weren't told.
So you were in the assembly area. But you knew, presumably, you were not sort of destined for the sort of the initial assault
No,
wave.
We knew as an armoured division we wouldn't be in the boats. The armour which was assisting the landings was specialised armour. 79 division, which were the funnies. This included the flail tanks, the flamethrowers, and all these sort of funnies. The floating tanks, sea-going tanks as well. They were not us. We were armoured breakout, theoretical.
So at what stage did you get the order to move?
Well, on D-Day, which was the 6th of June, as you may remember, we were in the middle of a route march, at least my troop was, and we were right at the top end of the route march, and somebody came out and said the BBC had just... So in an enthusiasm, we belted back, expecting to be put on the next transport. But of course this didn't happen. Ruined 1 or 2 feet, I can tell you that, but nevertheless, we got back and we were moved to the holding area at Wanstead Flats on the 13th of June. Wanstead Flats, and we stayed at Wanstead Flats, now experiencing the first of the flying bombs that didn't bother us until the 19th of June. And I think this was because the storm had occurred. We were supposed to go earlier than that, but the storm came, and we boarded ships at Tilbury. I think it was on the 19th of June, which incidentally was my joining date of the army. And we lay off Southend for a bit because of the tail end of the storm and this sort of thing. So we didn't land in Normandy until about the 23rd, I think it was, of June. I think 7th Armoured went in to support at the beginning. 11th Armoured went in before us, and then we came in after 11th Armoured. 11th and Guards were 8th Corps, which was supposed to be an armoured corps at that particular time. We landed dry, although we'd spent all our time waterproofing the vehicles, but the landing craft in which my troop was put into, the sub-lieutenant decided he had enough for the day. I think the enthusiasm was wearing out and he was going to dry out, so we landed and we waited till the thing dried out, and then we moved up into a holding area in Normandy. My memory of that was that I'm not particularly fond of onions, but the cook thought that I was, and I was given an onion to eat every night. Which wasn't too good, but there we go. But we're on, yes.
Whereabouts did you land at Arromanches?
Arromanches is one of the beaches of the British zone. You know that, don't you? Yes. I don't know where it was, but the 2IC of the squadron, no, he wasn't the 2IC at that time, but he became the 2IC. He said he landed at Arromanches, but I think we landed slightly to the left of Arromanches. I can't remember any town. We landed on a beach anyway. No problems.
And then went forward to...
We went to our holding area, yeah.
Whereabouts?
Somewhere near Bayeux. Now, when we got there, and the rest of the squadron had gathered together again, we started to do tank tracks because the roads were allocated to the the vehicle, so we would set off and do tank tracks associated with movement of the division between A and B when the division moved. This meant preparing ditches for the tanks to cross over and things of this sort of ilk, and getting hedges out of the way, you know, generally route marking on that sort of stuff. We did quite a bit of water points as well at that particular stage, and quite honestly I can't remember doing a single water point myself, but I think some of the squadron was involved in water points. We seemed to be doing tank tracks more than anything else. And then fairly early on in the game, the CRE decided we should hear what incoming fire was like. So we were all sent down in bits and pieces towards the front line at that particular stage in the game. And my memory is of taking the troop down to what was called the Scottish Corridor. An attack had been made by the 15th Scottish Division, and they'd gone down, I think it was to the Eudon rather than the Orne, but a very small river. And we'd got to a level crossing, and things looked a bit sort of quiet. I decided we would stop there, but no sooner had we stopped than an incoming mortar fire. Unfortunately, there were a lot of slit trenches round about, so we were fairly safe, but it was our first experience of incoming mortar fire, rather disturbing.
How did you react?
I wasn't particularly happy. But the first time you hear it, you have no idea. But you very quickly learn the stuff that's coming close and the stuff that's not coming close. So you very, very quickly are able to determine what is the dangerous shell fire, or mortar fire, or naval welfare fire, and that which is going for somebody else. So you very quickly learn. The other thing which the CRE decided was he would give us experience of minefields. And we all had a shot at a German minefield, which in fact was shoe mines rather than that. And there was a path on the cliff with S mines. I mentioned that I was walking with one of my mad corporals, Corporal Pratt, and he stood on this S mine, which only came up to waist high. And as you know, it bursts and scatters then, but it failed to go off after that. So that was all right. But during the exercise with the shoe mines, which you have to do with prodding because your instruments, your mine detectors won't detect it, and it was in cornfields, one of our sappers in one troop lost his foot. So that was our first sort of mine casualty. We had started to pick up shelling and mortar casualties once or twice. And looking at the war diary, references made to two sappers being hospitalised with, what did they call it? We used to call it being bomb happy, unable to withstand the pressures. But I don't remember, none of my section, none of my troop were affected by this. I think they were probably headquarters sappers anyway. That was the beginning of the shooting match. Now this took us from about the 23rd of June to the early July. And then Montgomery, by this time, we were then being put more in the picture, and we were being told that the British Army was on the left, and this was going to take the weight of the German effort to allow the Americans to break out in due course of time. We were told all this. There was this operation Goodwood, which was to involve three armoured divisions, 11th Guards and 7th, in that order, on the far left of the front, to drive through to the Falaise Plain and then break out from there. We were never told that it was to be a breakout, but the intention was, as far as I can remember, that having achieved our objectives, if the thing was right enough, then people would go on ahead. But we were never given sort of Paris or the like as an objective. We were given objectives which were just beyond Caen on the left-hand side. Now, on that particular operation, I was left out of battle, and another officer from 615 Squadron was left out of battle, LOB. Now, that was the only time that any of the sappers were left out of battle. I think that some of the armoured regiments and the infantry regiments of the Guards did leave some of their people out of battle on more than one occasion. But after the fiasco of the first attempt, I rejoined the squadron, and I was sent forward to the Grenadiers, who were up in a place the outside of the other side of Caen. But by that time, the Germans had got everybody pinned down, and we weren't going to go anywhere. In addition to that, the heavens opened and the ground just turned to mud and one couldn't move at all. It really was terrible. So that sort of shooting match collapsed. And that was the only time I was left out of battle. We came back from there and we hung back behind Caen because there was an intention that the Canadians might have another shot. And they did try, and we were set behind them to break out if they got through. But they got held up as well, so that petered out. And this must be somewhere around about the middle of July, I suppose. We then moved back, and at this stage, the Americans had started their breakout, and they had taken Caumont, and they were trying to get further round. They weren't round; they hadn't achieved the breakout yet, but they were moving towards it. And they were advancing more readily than we were on the left, although the British were constantly making little assaults to take little bridgeheads with divisional troops. And then we were hitched on then to 11th Armoured again to form a corps. And we were on the left of the corps troops. And this must have been about the, I suppose, towards the end of July.
How was squadron morale during this time?
Oh, no problems. We were losing people. We got shelled. We got mortared. We lost the odd people. One unfortunate occasion in 3 Troop, they were showing some newly joined sappers what not to do with a regal mine, and somebody did what he shouldn't do, and the bloody thing exploded and killed the NCO and 2 other sappers. But these things were just what you came up against. Morale was fine. The food was reasonable. The weather wasn't bad. People knew what the hell they were doing, and that was about it. And then we came to, well, one of the lessons of Goodwood was that it was no use trying to operate as an armoured brigade and then expecting the infantry brigade to trot up at night time and hold the position. The armour was too far in front. The vehicles in which the infantry brigade moved were soft vehicles, and they weren't capable of cross-country work, so they were restricted to roads. So there was quite a lot of palaver on the first 2 nights up front, with the tanks being thoroughly exposed and no infantry protection. So the general decided that this was not on, and that he would link his infantry battalion to a corresponding Guards armoured battalion. Now, it just so happened that the 2nd Irish and the 5th Coldstream were in adjoining fields, so they were linked together as a particular section, and I was nominated to look after that little lot. Now, the 1st Grenadiers and the 2nd Grenadiers Infantry and Armoured Battalion was another group, and Tony Jones of Number 1 Troop looked after that. And that's the way the division operated from then onwards, with the tanks and the infantry mostly riding on the backs of the tanks. There would be the lead squadron with no infantry on it, and the next 2 squadrons had tank infantry on their backs. So the infantry were right up front with the tanks. This was more of the way of the German army, but they had proper vehicles. They moved their infantry in armoured vehicles, as long with their tanks, the grenadiers, panzer grenadiers. The Canadians at the breakout for Falaise, their commander, and they were very good, the Canadians, I can't remember his name, I think it was Simpson, took his guns out of his armoured gun, armoured